from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
We have fought our way back, and we know in our hearts that for the United States of America, the best is yet to come.
Coming up on Forum, 4 more years for President Obama. We'll assess last night's re-election victory for the president over challenger Mitt Romney, who struck a tone of optimism in his concession speech.
This election is over, but our principles endure. I believe that the principles upon which this nation was founded are the only sure guide to a resurgent economy and to renewed greatness.
We'll break down the voting patterns in last night's presidential election and in key congressional races. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Well, the results are in for election 2012, and in this opening hour, we're going to discuss the outcome with a panel of experts. I should say the outcomes, not only have a look at the re-election of President Obama, but also talk about the congressional races and how things stack up. And Bruce Cain is with us, professor of political science and director designate of the Bill Lane Center for the American West at Stanford. He's in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. Bruce, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Chris Lehane, who's here with us in studio, Democratic consultant and a partner in Fabiani and Lehane, spent 6 years in the Clinton White House and was Vice President Al Gore's press secretary throughout the 2000 campaign. Welcome, Chris Lehane.
Thanks. It's always fun to be here.
Good to have you here. Also good to have Tammy Frisbee here in studio with us, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and an advisor to the Romney campaign. She teaches American politics at Stanford. And Tammy Frisbee, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks to all of you for being here. And Bruce Cain, let me begin with you. Let's talk about a little analysis in terms of the election or the re-election of President Obama to 4 more years. I'm not the most prescient political prognosticator, as you well know, but I've been saying it all depended on turnout. And as far as the turnout went, young people of color turned out.
That's right. I mean, the way people put it was, will this turnout be more like 2008? Or will it be more like 2004 or 2010? And the answer came back last night. It was going to be more like 2008. And we had this long dispute between the people that were doing the national polls and the people that are doing the state polls. The numbers, we saw discrepancies between the state and national poll numbers that were perplexing. We've seen them in the past, but they were much more stable and pronounced this time. And the theory at the time was that the Obama turnout machine was getting people to the polls who on many other election occasions wouldn't be there. In other words, they were targeting people that were occasional voters as well as persuadables. And there was a big fight. Nate Silver took a lot of grief from Republicans who were saying, no, there's momentum that you're not picking up and that your turnout assumptions are wrong. And, of course, Gallup and Rasmussen were on that side, too. And in the end, it turned out that Obama's machine was real and that the state polls were picking up something that was true. And, yes, you can't count on minority voters not to show up, especially if the Democratic political machine targets them and really makes an effort to get their votes there.
Yeah, Nate Silver is looking awfully good this morning. There was a kind of firewall, though, that was built up by the Democrats, and let's talk about that. I mean, particularly with respect to not only the Rust Belt, but Ohio turned out, of course, to be key in this election, and Ohio was doing better economically, but it was also a place where President Obama could crow about the bailout.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a whole bunch of things that we're going to look back and see that they were fairly important. But right at the top of the list, I think, is going to be the bailout. That affected, obviously, the economies of Michigan and northern Ohio. And what stands out, and everybody notices over the last couple days, which is that working-class whites was going to be the problem area. That's always been the problem area for Obama, but he did better than a Democrat would normally expect. He got about 42% of the white vote. in Ohio, and that combined with picking up very strong support from the Black and Latino communities was enough to do it. I mean, it's not. There were some states like Iowa and Wisconsin where Obama did much better with white voters. So, you know, there still is a bit of a problem there for Obama with working class whites. But the point is that the bailout really did make a difference. And the fact that Romney had made some statements that were problematic, and then the attack on the suggestion that the auto companies were sending jobs to China, and the blowback from the executives, all that, I think, just solidified what had been a 2 or 3 year project of really, trying to court an extra support out of the working class whites in Ohio. All that came together for Obama very nicely.
Well, he was also helped by some rather foolish statements by candidates Aiken and Murdoch, and by Sandy probably as well, and certainly by Bill Clinton. I mean, there were a lot of things that seemed to come together for the president. But the popular vote is so close, and the states are so divided in terms of red and blue. Does the president have a mandate in your judgment here? Or can he say he has a mandate?
I think the mandate is not a mandate to pursue a gung-ho Democratic, liberal agenda. It is to try to work with the Republicans to resolve the problems, particularly the fiscal cliff that is, facing us. And, the fact that the Republicans were able to hold on to the House, and the fact, as you say, that the president had a very broad victory, but also one that was rather shallow in the sense that there were narrow margins in a lot of these states. I think that's just a signal that you want to avoid what it seems to me presidents have been doing for the last three or four elections, which is reading small margins into being very large mandates for their party platform. And I think the president is smart enough to know that he paid a price. He was willing to pay it for the Affordable Care Act and for the stimulus and the rest. But that even though you have these structural advantages we were just talking about, you can, even with the structural advantages, flip support very quickly, because the number of independents in this country has been going up. And independents, even though they lean towards the Democratic or Republican, many of them, there's a difference. We're seeing in political science evidence there is a difference between somebody who is a leaning Democrat or a leaning Republican who classifies themselves as an independent, as opposed to somebody who is a true Democrat or Republican. They will defect on you sometimes, particularly if they don't like the economic conditions or they think you're overreading your mandate. So I think Obama must know this, and I think he's got to really find a way to keep working with the Republicans, even though we suspect that they will be obstructionists on many key issues.
And again, Bruce Kane with us from Washington is professor of political science at Stanford. Democratic consultant Chris LaHaines here with us in studio. Chris, president's still got a GOP majority in the House, and he's got a lot of battles up ahead, not only the fiscal cliff, which Bruce mentioned, but, trying to get the deficit down and certainly trying to get the economy back on track. What do you foresee here?
Well, it's an interesting question about the mandate. And I look at it just, I think, slightly differently. First of all, presidents make mandates if they want to make mandates. George W. Bush lost a popular vote and basically declared that he had a mandate. But I think the mandate in this particular election is, how do the Republicans react, right? Because not only did they lose the presidential election, but they lost races in states that they probably should have won, particularly on the Senate side. And so if you're the Republicans and you're looking at this, a party that's been dominated by the Tea Party, a party that has not been interested in compromise and getting to the middle, right? And is there going to be interest now, particularly on issues that would play in theory to their political advantage, right? Are they going to look to actually compromise on something like immigration? Are they going to look to compromise on the fiscal cliff? Now, I do think that there are going to be some political forces in play that we may not have fully appreciated before the election, just because of not only what happened at the presidential campaign, but also because of what happened in a lot of these states on the Senate side. And if you're the Republican Party, you have to take a step back, look in the mirror, and say, our party has a brand problem, right? Now, the flip of it is, right, the president began this process last night talking about, at the end of his speech, one nation together, moving forward, right? So can he continue to use the bully pulpit of the presidency to build off of what happened last night and look for that common ground? But I think for the president to do that, right, has he learned the lessons of the last 4 years that to be an effective president, you actually have to make the public case. You have to create a narrative. You have to do events day in and day out to drive it, to ultimately bring people together. And so I think it's going to be an interesting combination. I actually am more optimistic this morning about the idea that our country is actually going to come together and work together because of how the election played out, because of how these Senate races played out, and because of what the president was saying last night, and because of the changing demographics in the country really mean that for both of these parties, there's a pretty compelling argument to actually look for places to work together for their own political self-interest long term.
But there's also going to have to be a lot of swapping and horse trading and backroom deals. I mean, that's how legislation, you know, like pork is made and all that. And you can foresee, for example, the president saying, well, I'm going to have to go harder on entitlements in order to get taxes, those kinds of things. I mean, those deals are almost potential. And yet what you said about the Tea Party is particularly instructive here because the Tea Party has been, I mean, they did pretty well in the early campaigns, but in terms of the races, they did very poorly. So are they going to continue to be obstructing, you think?
Well, that's what I think is interesting for the Republicans to make a decision, right, which is that if they continue on the Tea Party route, right, that is a route to continuing political losses, right? You've had two election cycles in a row when the Republicans should have won many more Senate seats than they did. And they lost in no small part because of the role that the Tea Party played internally within the party, the types of candidates that were produced, where they pushed the party ideologically, right? And, you know, you take a look at some of the demographic data out there and recognizing it was a, you know, a relatively narrow national vote win, but a pretty overwhelming electoral college win, but also wins in all of these Senate races. You look at the demographics, the Latino gap, the gender gap, particularly with unmarried women and suburban women, the millennial gap. I mean, those are all gaps that are not going to go away unless their party changes. And if those gaps continue, the Republican Party nationally ends up on a similar road that the Republican Party in California has been on, you know, which is sort of the road to nowhere, the party of nada, right? And back in 1992, California was a purple state, a swing state. Republicans decided to take a specific view and approach the Latino vote in this state. And a generation later, the Republican Party does not exist in California as an effective, viable force. Last night, it looks like that you now have supermajorities in both the state assembly, the state Senate, and you have a Republican Party that really does not exist. So does the national Republican leadership, does the national Republican Party take some lessons from what has taken place here in California over the last 20 years, take some lessons from what took place on this particular election and begin to apply it? And I do think that at the end of the day, politicians make decisions based on their self-interest. Am I going to get elected? Am I going to get reelected? If you're the Republicans and you're looking at demographics and you're looking at what happened last night, I think you do need to begin to take a step back and recognize that for your long-term viability, you need to start doing things in a fundamentally different way. And in that lies
even
the potential.
Even if you signed the pledge in blood to Gordon Norquist?
Well, I mean, the Grover Norquist
Grover,
pledge, right? The Grover Norquist pledge, see how it played out in California last night. You now have supermajorities of both the Democrat and both bodies of the legislature. You had revenue measures that passed in California for the first time in a long time, right? I mean, that approach does not seem to be working, at least as valued by are you winning elections or losing elections.
Well, let's bring Tammy Frisbee into this. Again, she's a research fellow at Hoover and was an advisor to the Romney campaign. I mean, this is hearing a lot of grumbling within the Republican Party about the necessity to reach out and have a wider net, bring in Latinos particularly. I suppose one can speculate what would have happened if Governor Romney had decided to run with someone like Marco Rubio, but that didn't happen. Women, millennials, you know, you just heard Chris Lahane say where the Republicans didn't really make the impact. What are they going to do?
That is all the harsh reality that confronts Republicans. But the harsh reality is also that there is not a single Republican Party, just as there is not a monolithic Democratic Party. One of Bruce Kane's former colleagues, the late Nelson Polsby, one of the finest political scientists and scholars of American politics, once said that there are not two parties in American politics. There are 102 parties in American politics. So when I listen to people talk about what Republicans need to do and the calculations that Republicans need to make about what the party needs to do to win elections, I just think about those 102 parties and what's going on in each state and also what's going on in each congressional district. And it's a massive problem of political coordination.
Well, what about the role of the Tea Party? As Chris Lehane said, it seemed like to some extent they were thwarted and don't necessarily have the clout that they had.
Well, when you look at those Senate races and the track record for the last couple of Senate election cycles, this is a big problem. They do not seem to be able to get their candidates through the general election. We've once again seen this create problems for not just the number of seats that Republicans have, but in this case, we now don't have a Republican majority in the Senate. And of course, with the effective supermajority rule we have now in the Senate that basically, we filibuster almost everything, requiring 60 votes to do any legislative business in the Senate. You can say, well, who holds the majority is not that important, but certainly it has some advantages. It gives you committee chairman. And so the Republicans, you know, do need to think about, you know, what are you going to do about the influence of the Tea Party? But it's not as simple as getting everybody in the same room and taking a vote, right? So if I had the answer for what the Tea Party should be doing and what the Republican leadership should be doing, I'd be doing very well for myself. And I think that the reality is that I don't have that answer. And right now, I don't think anybody else does either.
Well, but let's just think about this for a moment. I mean, 10% of the vote was a Latino vote, and 70% of that vote went for President Obama. So, I mean, can the Republican Party, maybe many parties in one, but isn't going to have to, for example, soften up and get more flexible on immigration? Mitt Romney took a pretty tough line because he was playing to the conservative base.
Yes, and I expect that you will see efforts at that nationally, that as we gear up for 2016, those people who think that they are going to make a run for the White House are going to be taking their own personal positions, in particular focusing on immigration reform, a way to come up with a functional system that can reach out to Latinos. When you were talking about choices that Mitt Romney made during the campaign, you mentioned the choice of VP. I think probably more important would have been the choice not to use the words self-deportation during the Republican primary debate. I think that did more damage than anything with the Latino community. So national candidates or prospective national candidates are going to be focusing on these issues. And that is really all that one can do and hope that that filters down into the states. And that's the kind of model that when you had the run up to 1994 and the efforts by Newt Gingrich to retake the House, which were ultimately successful after 40 years in the wilderness, that sort of top down approach can actually work, to have national leaders trying to get down there and work at the grassroots to use their lead to get others to follow.
Well, when you talk about unfortunate use of language, it was probably unfortunate in some ways that Governor Romney talked about binders full of women, but it was perhaps even more hurtful to the Republicans to have senatorial candidates in Indiana and Missouri talk about rape the way they did. I mean, within the party, is there a reassessment, do you think, of attitudes toward women or what is perhaps even rhetorically said about women that can be very much foot in mouth and cause a great deal of despair in terms of the candidate's potential?
I hope so. On the binders full of women, I think the evidence is less clear on that, on the way that fell with the electorate. It was funny. The Tumblr is good. If you haven't checked it out, there are some good jokes that came out of that. But we've actually been doing some polling on awareness about election events, and that particular line was got awareness of about 50% of the respondents in our national survey, which was about in line with other campaign events as we moved into the election, but not as high as, say...
Well, 47% was a much more damaging comment, yeah.
Exactly, and that had awareness above 80%. In fact, 83% of all independents had heard about that. And the only comment that we got that matched that only campaign event was the president's announcement about gay marriage earlier in the campaign cycle. So, yes, I think that is much more damaging than the binders full of women comments. But on the Senate races, I mean, certainly we're looking at a gender gap in the exit polls somewhere between 13 and 14 points. If there are problems with exit polls, I'll be interested to look at additional data as that comes in. But this is a huge
problem.
It's
pretty significant, though.
Yes, significant gender gap, even when you realize that historically in presidential elections that there's a Democratic advantage.
If it would have been only white men winning, Mitt Romney would be president. I mean, it comes down to that in many respects. Let me invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, our toll-free number is available, and we'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts and reflecting about the results, and there are many results that we haven't even talked about. I mean, we have the first member of the Senate, Tammy Baldwin, who is a lesbian, first LGBT member of the United States Senate. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary in a way, in terms of its impact. And there are many other things to talk about in terms of individual races. I mentioned the race in both Indiana and in Missouri that lost two candidates possible seats because of their remarks. We also didn't talk about the race in Massachusetts, where Elizabeth Warren managed to win a victory. Let me invite you to join us, and our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have some reflections about last night's election, or if you have some thoughts you'd like to bring to the fore here, and please feel free to join our conversation, particularly about the where President Obama is going to go in his second term. And he said he wanted to move forward and unify the country. It's a very stirring speech, but how much can that be done? And what about the Republicans? And those of you who are Republicans, love to hear from you where you think the party can go at this point, where there seems to be a good deal of defeat and paralysis. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. We welcome your calls and emails. And you can also, of course, go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. And you can also join the conversation by going to our Facebook page or Twitter. And you can tweet us at our handle, which is @KQEDForum. Let me go back for a moment, Bruce Cain, to the campaign. In some ways, it was a pretty brilliant campaign.
On the part of Obama.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And one thing we haven't talked about, aside from the fact that they did the micro-targeting, is, you know, there was a lot of apprehension on the part of Democrats going in about what Citizen United and the related cases would mean for Democratic fortunes. And I think what we learned out of this is that that some of these fears were just exaggerated, that Obama was able, for the most part, to raise the money he needed, because while some of the Supreme Court had opened up the coffers of the trade unions and the corporations, there was still a very healthy amount of money that was coming from small donors, that Obama was able to get more money from small donors than Romney was, and that the Internet has made that a lot cheaper as an enterprise. We saw a lot of outside money coming in, and so far it doesn't look like it made a huge difference. Let's take the California congressional races. There was a lot of outside spending on both sides coming in, but in the end, I'm not sure that we're going to say the money made the, you know, the big difference there. So, you know, obviously there's going to be a push to do something about the disclosure. But, you know, in a way, in an odd sort of way, the Republicans were hurt by doing, and Romney was hurt by the fact that he was relying on these outside groups, because they were paying more money for their ads, and they were able to run fewer ads than the Democrats were. And many of those ads came at the wrong time of the day, because they weren't getting, you know, they were making their purchases very late in the cycle. So I think that's another thing that came out of this, is that Obama's, if we're talking about the effectiveness of this campaign, he was able to really hit the fundraising totals that he needed to keep up with the Republicans.
Well, we're just about a minute away from a break here, and I want to bring a quick question in to Chris Lehane and to Tammy Frisbee. We had seconds left here, but the congressional redistricting, it really did make a big difference in this race, didn't it? I mean, the race isn't per se, Chris?
Certainly in California.
In California specifically.
Yes, I assume you're talking about California. Yeah. Yes, I mean, certainly in California, you suddenly had, in particular, Democrats v. Democrats, right? And so you had the race down in Brad Sherman, Howard Berman, where you had two long-serving Democrats having to run against each other. You had the redistricting outside of Sacramento in the Barra-Lundgren race, which we still don't know the results of, but improving margins for the Democrats. And in this state, too, with the demographics changing, the redistricting was also impacted by those ever-changing demographics. So certainly the redistricting pitted Democrats against Democrats and also made some races a lot more competitive.
And Tammy Frisbee, before we break here, who's going to be the national leader now for the Republican Party?
I think Chris Christie's made a pretty good case for himself over the last week.
Okay, when we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The results of the election 2012 are in. We're discussing the outcome with a panel of political experts. Chris Lehane with us in studio, Democratic consultant and a partner at Fabiani and Lehane, and Tammy Frisbee, research fellow at Hoover and an advisor to the Romney campaign. And Bruce Cain, with us by phone, professor of political science and director designate of the Bill Lane Center for the American West at Stanford. And emails and Facebook remarks are coming in. And by the way, if you'd like to join us and put in your two cents, we certainly welcome hearing from you. You can go to our Facebook page or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or you can post questions or comments on our website, which is at kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or call us. Lines are full, but we'll go to your calls in just a moment. And the toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. Marilyn writes, would you please comment on how to repair campaign rules so that we never, ever spend that amount of money again? If it is a matter of getting it on the ballot, I'm sure we could get enough names. Also, England has, as I understand it, only about 3 weeks to campaign. Can we not do that as well so that the incumbent president can actually leave the White House for a much shorter time? Well, Bruce Cain, we've talked about this before. Some thoughts?
Not possible, however desirable it might be or seem to people. Basically, the American Constitution has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to make campaign contributions and expenditures a First Amendment right, which is very carefully guarded. And so you really can't limit expenditures. You can't limit independent expenditures. You can't limit personal expenditures. And so the British system is just not something that we can have because our First Amendment tradition is very different. And also, to be honest, even though $5 billion is a big number, compared to what we spend on advertising, commercial advertising, isn't really that big number. The real problem is not the amount of money that's spent. It's that the product that you get for the $5 billion, when half of the budgets on campaigns are devoted to TV ads, and the TV ads are really repetitive, largely dumb, stupid, misleading, et cetera. That's what really is bothering people more than anything else. I don't think we begrudge the fact that the money's used for get out the vote or to, you know, remind people how to vote. I think it's the ads that really drive people crazy.
Yeah, I heard back from relatives in Ohio who were almost unable to watch television because the ads were so saturated and ubiquitous. Mark from Berkeley, Tammy Frisbee writes, let's be clear about something. Yesterday's election was the culmination of a four-year project by the Republicans to thwart every initiative by President Obama and make him a one-term president. They put all their eggs in the basket of making him fail utterly and thereby win back the presidency in both houses of Congress. Instead, they may have inflicted a fatal wound on themselves in the eyes of the American people. The future of their party seems obvious, change or oblivion.
This election aside, I don't think that the American people tend to give mandates one way or the other. And that's why you've seen over the last few election cycles this pattern of presidents claiming mandates and then engaging along with members of Congress in policy overreach, and the American public 2 years later in the midterm election slapping their hands and bringing in huge waves of Democrats and then Republicans into Congress. So when I think about what message Americans are sending here, that's just not how most Americans make their decisions when they walk into the election booth.
And Chris Lehane, Steve comments on our Facebook page. Nate Silver got everything right. The country is becoming more progressive with marijuana and gay marriage winning acceptance. True, certainly in a couple of the elections yesterday. Money and TV ads are a failing way to win an election. Social media is increasingly important, tweeting victory. The president can now do what he really wants without worrying about reelection. How will he handle legalized drugs on a federal level? Well, it brings up that broader question of not necessarily a mandate, but you know, if he's whispering in Medvedev's ear or whatever, you know, how much does he feel that doesn't have to worry about reelection? Does that give him a kind of freedom?
Well, and we've touched on this in earlier programs. Right? I've always thought that the president's biggest challenge, and other people have been making this observation for several years, which is giving the public a broader sense of his thesis, his theory of government, where he's taking the country, right? And this election, for the most part, was about a bunch of small ideas. And really what the president, I think, effectively did in this election at the end of the day is make this an up or down vote about trust. Beginning in May, they recognized that if they raised basic trust issues about Mitt Romney, that would play to the president's strength, which is even when people didn't approve of the job he was doing, which, by the way, came back up to 50% by the end. But even if they didn't, they always had a personally high favorability rating for him, which is predicated in a trust. And so their campaign was designed to raise basic trust issues about Mitt Romney day in and day out. Now, going forward, what does that mean, right? And I think you began to get a bit of this last night in the speech, in particular, you know, when he began to touch on the idea of what type of a country are we going to leave for our kids, you know, this generational argument. And to me, that generational argument is potentially that type of organizing platform that he could use going forward, right? It's an organizing platform to talk about how you're going to deal with a fiscal crisis. We all need to come together, make compromises on both sides for the best interests of the country and for our children, right? On an issue like immigration, that's another one that would fit into that generational argument. Climate change, another one that could potentially – and those are all issues that he touched on last night, which would be all the types of issues that if you're looking at a second-term president who wants to have a real legacy, who wants to have a real impact in the next 4 years, are issues where he could potentially move on under that generational brand. And by the way, all issues, if you look at them, that poll well over 60% with the public. And we talked about earlier, which is, are there market forces in play that are going to force the Republicans out of their own self-interest to begin to look for areas of common ground? And I think if the president can give a larger brand into that, you know, firmly sort of ensconced in his trust and the fact that the country does trust him, and look for two or three issues where Republicans are going to want to come and work with him, I think there's the potential to do some pretty interesting stuff. And as I said earlier, count me as one who was not who thought that Obama was going to win, who was not particularly optimistic that we would deal with gridlock. But coming out of last night and seeing how some of this stuff played out, I am much more positive today that there's actually a place to go.
Are you more positive, Tammy Frisbee?
I am more positive because I think that this fiscal cliff is going to force people into a situation where if they have any concern at all for legacy or institutional capacity of Congress and the presidency, they will need to come to the table and compromise. And I think Chris's point about the intergenerational equity issues is a very interesting one, because when you look at entitlement reform, big question is how are Democrats going to go out to their base and say, you know, we really do need to reform these programs in a major way. And if they can do it by saying what we're doing is making this intergenerational argument, that might be a way that they could send that message out there and actually make some progress.
But, you know, Chris mentioned that President Obama touched on all these matters that certainly, well, one would assume galvanized a lot of the voters and play to their interests. He also talked about people. He mentioned people of all different colors, and he mentioned women, and he mentioned millennials and gays and lesbians and so forth. And you looked at the crowd and you saw, really, a lot of young people and people of all different colors. I mean, it was, you know, sort of like a liberal dream. They were. You don't see that with Mitt Romney. You see mainly white people, and you see mainly a lot of older people. And how to bring in, again, the younger people or the people of color is a major kind of challenge for the Republican Party.
Yeah, to take just the millennial issues, the Republican Party needs to figure out a way to translate its economic message down to voters who typically don't have very high turnout rates. I mean, you did see, I think the exit polls are showing turnout under 30 at 19%. That would be up 1% from 2008. But that is, excuse me, that is 19% of the electorate. And that still, though, is not a high turnout rate compared to turnout overall or turnout among other groups. And even when young Americans do turn out, they don't tend to be as aware of what the policy positions are. So part of the challenge here is to move beyond the energy and the hope, which obviously are real things that are producing real results for the Democratic parties, and figure out a way to get the Republican message on policy to bore through that. And that is a real challenge for Republicans moving forward.
Well, let's bring our callers into this discussion. And we begin, Dave, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm on my bike, so I just got off my bike for a second. But quoting Robert Reich and Paul Krugman, my two favorite columnists, I think the central issue, honestly, is taxing the rich and a little bit of wealth redistribution. I'm a local architect. I prefer doing public housing and having government-supported architectural projects and necessarily working for rich folks. And I think that we'd be putting most of the country back to work if there was a real WPA-type program. And I'm hoping that that Obama reads a little bit more of Krugman and a little bit more of Wright, maybe can start acting on a certain kind of unwritten mandate. I do think the American people very much have a mandate. They want a little wealth redistribution from the higher income sources, and they want public public infrastructure projects and public housing projects, et cetera. And I welcome comments.
Well, actually, I'd like to welcome what Chris Lehane has to say just about the realistic possibility of these kinds of things, and particularly what kind of economic advice is President Obama going to get now with Tim Geithner leaving the office of the Secretary of the Treasury? You know, a lot of Democrats were upset about his appointing the same pretty much folks that were advising economically for George W. Bush. We're going to see a change there? And
so two points on it, and it's an interesting question. First of all, I would posit that what the president did with the quote-unquote stimulus program, you know, in and historical analysis was very significant. I think one of the problems, and this goes to something we've talked about, which is that there wasn't a narrative out there. It wasn't branded. What people don't realize, the amount of resources that were invested in this country that I think are going to have enormously a long-term benefit for us, whether it was in public education areas, whether it was on alternative energy. There's a whole bunch of stuff with a whole bunch of money spent. And there's been a series of books actually coming out talking about what a historical investment that was in our country that is beginning to pay off. But again, it goes to the larger issue, which is that, you know, the fact that you have a caller who's coming from that perspective who, you know, is asking questions about it when, in fact, something like that has already occurred is pretty telling, right? And then let's talk about going forward, right? To me, the first big issue is how do you deal, you know, with the fiscal crisis and the fiscal cliff? I mean, that is going to really drive everything. And I think that, you know, Tammy had raised the issue earlier, which is, you know, do people overread or overinterpret an election? I think that's a very fair point. But ultimately, to me, this is – and you could get people in the room right now in D.C., and if they're willing to put aside the politics, figure this out pretty quickly. I mean, you have to have both. You have to have cuts, and you have to deal with the tax issue and the revenue. And I think one –
the Dow went down 100,
right. But one of the – I realize it, but one of the issues that I do think was very clear in this election, right? I said earlier that this was an election about a lot of small issues, and there was, you know, effectively a negative campaign. But one of the real differences that was discussed and debated, you know, was whether there should be higher revenue on wealthier Americans. I mean, that was one of the very specific issues with two very different paths that were laid out. So I think to the extent that the president can go back and say, look, I won a significant Electoral College win. I won the popular vote. This was one of, if not the core public policy issue that people had to decide on. You know, we need to use that as a base to begin these discussions. We need to do both. But you can't end up in a situation, nor do I think he's going to end up in a situation, nor can he end up in a situation where you don't have both. You're going to have to do both to get there.
Let's bring more callers on. Dwayne, you're our next caller. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks. I wanted to ask the guests about what the prospects in the midterm elections in 2014, what the prospects of the Democrats are for flipping the House. And if that is a possibility, shouldn't the president pursue a very strong centrist agenda and be confrontational with the House of Representatives on issues like immigration and tax reform, where national polls are on his side, and not sort of shy away from painting the obstructionist House into a corner with the threat that the House could flip, and in his last 2 years, he could really go strong?
Yeah, it's an important question, Dwayne. I thank you for it. And let me go to Bruce Kane on that. And Bruce, maybe you could opine a little bit on where Nancy Pelosi fits into the whole picture of leadership now as we move toward 2014.
Well, in D.C., the rumors are that she may not want to stay on. I think it's, you know, given the outcome last night, I think she has some choice. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't a massive movement one way or the other, but it was generally a good night for the Democrats. But there's a lot of speculation that she may step aside, that Steny Hoyer may move up. And, you know, it's hard to say at this point whether what the Republicans are going to do. The sentiment in D.C. has been on the fiscal issues to sort of push things off. And to buy some time, but it's very clear now that Obama has the advantage, the negotiation advantage, because the taxes, the Bush tax cuts, do lapse, and so it's going to be in D.C. Many people thought that even if Romney had won, the Republican Party was likely going to split over issues of governance. That the fissures inside the party were real, and so the real question is whether the Republican Party acts like, as somebody mentioned earlier, the California Republican Party, that is, it sort of retreats into a shell, plays the obstruction game, or whether what we're seeing in D.C. is real splits between the establishment Republicans and the Tea Party types, whether the establishment Republicans see it in their interest to try to do some real negotiation now that the terms really are favoring Obama.
And let me thank the caller and move right along to another caller, and that's Lark. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Two quick questions. Thanks. My first is, it occurred to me last night that Romney had lost a section of the female vote who may have been conservative when it came to their pocketbook, but recent comments by the two guys concerning rape and abortion and so on, just kind of, they couldn't hold their breath anymore. So that was one question. Do you think that really affected Romney with a certain section of the women vote? And then my second question is, it seems I never hear anyone address real poverty and the homeless situation. People talk about, you know, the middle class or people who have lost their jobs, but people who are like, have had no jobs forever or barely surviving on, you know, $12,000 a year, or homeless people, that I just never hear anyone refer to that. Thank you so much, and I love you and your show, Michael.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for the call. And we'll go first to you, Tammy Frisbee. You kind of indicated earlier that you really did think it hurt Governor Romney, those comments from Missouri and Indiana.
Over the next week, I'm going to be looking hard at that data, but I will be very surprised if you don't see an effect of several percentage points increasing the gender gap. When we looked at earlier in the primary, when there was the attention being paid to contraception and the president's decision to make birth control and contraception covered, mandate employers cover that under the Affordable Care Act, when all that attention was being paid to these women's issues, you saw the gender gap in the head-to-head between Obama and Romney, or Obama and Santorum, who was one of the other leaders in the Republican field at that point, grow to over 20%. So when women were out there listening to these issues, we saw that it was turning off Republicans. And turning off women, and it was turning off women to Romney in those head-to-heads in the primary, even though he wasn't making the comments.
It was also probably turning off a lot of women that he selected Paul Ryan as his running mate, who has a very strong position with respect to choice that forbids abortion even when there's incest or even when there's rape. And the fact of the matter is, you didn't see much of Paul Ryan in this campaign. I mean, he was almost as hidden as George W. Bush, not quite as much, but you didn't really see him front and center very much.
He was not doing a lot of national media. He was doing a lot of ground game. He was out there in Ohio a lot, coming from neighboring state of Wisconsin. But setting aside the position on the policy issue from a purely political strategy point, during that vice presidential debate, when the last substantive question of that debate was the abortion question, and Paul Ryan laid out eloquently his very firm position against abortion, there was a pit in my stomach about what that was going to mean on Election Day.
Well, Aaron writes on our Facebook page, it's not that Republicans need better outreach to women, minorities, and youth. It's their policies. I suppose that may sum up the attitude of many. Let me go back, Chris Lehane, to you with the second question that caller Lark brought up, and that is poverty. There's been a campaign by Tavis Smiley and Cornel West that I'm sure you're familiar with, really very critical of President Obama because of his not addressing questions of indigence and poverty and just the suffering that goes on, and making too much emphasis on the middle class.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. It's one of the interesting dynamics in the country, which is you have some of the poverty numbers out there are pretty astounding. And you have the growing gap between the wealthy and the less well-off. And, you know, it wasn't really an issue that was ever really discussed by any of the candidates, you know, in this campaign. Now, you know, ultimately, a stronger economy begins to address those issues. You know, at the end of the day, education is a key piece to addressing those issues. But when you're running in a presidential campaign, there's a reason why you're talking about the middle class, right? That's ultimately who you're talking about, because that's ultimately how you win a campaign. Now, on the other side of this, as the president begins to govern and look at ways, you know, is this an issue that is, I believe, near and dear to his heart, looking at his history, looking at his background? Yes, and I fully expect that it will be something he'll get into and talk about and find ways to address. The health care bill, by the way, as it begins to kick in 2014, is going to have an impact on those particular populations in terms of making health care more accessible. But, you know, one thing I just did want to circle back on, which is, you got the question about the policies, the Republican policies. If you think about this campaign and you look at the gaps with Latinos, with suburban women, with the millennials, you know, one of the interesting things that the Obama campaign did fairly early on was they made a bet about where they were going to win this election. And they began to focus on policies that would really drive that gap, right? So the DREAM Act with Latinos, millennials, I think the gay marriage and the position that the president took had a huge impact there. I think some of the women's issues that we talked about had a huge issue. And in each and every one of those issues, it really helped drive that stark compare and contrast on a particular policy that really mattered to that particular voter cohort, but ultimately went to the issue of trust, which was their meta-thematic in this campaign. So I think you have to give them huge credit for taking some stands on issues that, by the way, remember when the gay marriage thing happened, everyone was talking about the president was going to lose Ohio as a result of this because of how it was going to play out with the white vote, right? On the other hand, he boosted his numbers with specific voter cohorts and made the bet that, you know, that you were going to get a turnout that was going to be a different model than people had seen in the past and that he would win. They deserve huge credit for
that. So it may have been tactical, but also, you know, he was quoting Dr. Seuss saying, "I mean what I say and I say what I mean." And it had always been, you know, on that track.
Dr. Seuss, so Big Bird, it was the Sesame Street election.
It did. Well, let me actually, I saw a picture yesterday, a long line of voters, and somebody put Big Bird in there digitally. Sam, let's get you on here next. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually a Mexican-American voter, you know, and back in the early days of California, I was a Republican. And then, you know, the whole debacle with Pete Wilson really turned me off, and obviously a lot of Hispanics in the state. I think one of the things that we have to be careful with is, you know, the Democratic Party is a little bit smug about just sort of taking the Hispanic vote, especially the Mexican-American vote, for granted in this state. And the whole thing is that's precarious. It's like, it's still the lesser of two evils that we're voting with, because they haven't done anything for us really in the past. If you look at the DREAM Act, when we had the supermajority, nothing happened at that point. And then really Obama just put a stopgap measure in there to sort of, to go back to the Hispanic vote and try to get us. Yeah, he did. But, you know, we were watching that. And on top of that, you'd see this, a lot of insults going around still against the Mexican-American population. How does Obama have such a tin ear and put a Cuban-American as the ambassador of Mexico and then insult the whole country down there with the comments that he made that were, revealed in the Wikipedia, the WikiLeaks thing, and then all of a sudden, you know, still didn't recognize the fact that that was also going to obviously anger a lot of Mexicans here. And then the last point is that still, well, actually one more point after that, but you know, we have a
Chris, situation. You're not filibustering here.
No. Sorry, because there was a lot of comments that y'all were making there about
Sam,
the fact that you don't have anybody really talking about it. You know, the thing is that if you look at the fact that the question was brought up is how do the Republicans really change the demographics of what they're voting? It's very simple. I hear about this female incubator that you have for putting more women in politics. You know, the Republican Party is really not doing that. The Democrat Party is not doing that. When's the last time we had a Mexican-American governor or senators? If the Republicans want to turn this around, all they have to do is get a political incubator in place and start to put in Hispanics, Mexican-Americans from California, and make them part of the leadership there in California and make them start coming up with the policies for immigration, what have you, and let them lead that and put them in races instead of the typical white old guy that puts up there and says, oh, yes, not for Hispanics. But, the Democrats do that as well.
So, all right, Sam, listen, Tammy Frisbee, I think, is alerted to what you're saying here and is not necessarily taking notes, but certainly is mindful of the fact that somehow these Latinos have to be reached, Hispanics, whatever you want to. Whatever you were, I guess Hispanics is really more preferable, isn't it? Pam in Albany writes, would the Republicans have held the House without their redistricting efforts? And another listener, Brian in Mountain View, says, how much better might the Democrats' gains in the House have been if the radical gerrymandering by Republican-controlled state legislatures in the wake of the 2010 elections had not occurred? I hope we as a nation can improve the way districts are drawn before 2020. This is really your territory, Bruce Cade. You want to comment on how much gerrymandering or redistricting affected all?
Yeah, I mean, when you net over all the states, it wasn't as bad as it might have been. But there was definitely some movement towards the Republicans in the Republican-controlled states. That some of it was pushed back. For example, in Texas, they were forced to redo one of the seats, and it looks like that they might lose that seat. But clearly, there were some surprises. For example, the redistricting in California, if all the races that the Democrats are leading in win right now, it's quite possible the Democrats are going to pick up three or four seats. And similarly, in Illinois, there was a pickup there because of a Democratic-controlled
redistricting. And then in Maryland, the same thing. There was a seat that was created through a Democratic plan. So, yes, on balance, it was the Republicans did something they really needed to do, which is they shored up some of the seats of the Tea Party people in these states and made them more safely Republican. And, yes, that probably did cost on net the Democrats a few seats. But I don't think that was a major factor in what we saw last night.
Let me read another email here from Chris, who says, after growing up in California, serving 5-plus years active duty Army and now living in the Bay Area, since I am and always will be a Republican, but I'm an Andrew Sullivan Republican. Let's not focus on abolishing Obamacare because we're afraid of it. Let's make it better. Let's not focus on elections, but the real needs of the people and the country in which they live. Taxes will have to increase, so let's spend them as best we can. And Donna tweets, Obama won because the majority of people could not park their plane at Logan to go to a party. A lot of questions about the fiscal cliff. We have just seconds left here, but some thoughts from both of you in studio here. Tammy Frisbee?
I think that we have a very good chance of plunging over the fiscal cliff because the president right now is in a position where he has the power to free the Republicans in Congress from the Grover Norquist pledge. If we go over the fiscal cliff, the Bush tax rates go up, Republicans can then cut taxes on only those earning under $250,000 a year, say, and be in compliance with the Grover Norquist tax pledge. And I wonder if the president will feel impelled to do that. Of course, he's going to be getting pressure from Democrats in Congress not to raise taxes on American people before Christmas. So it will be interesting to see how that push and pull eventually plays out.
Well, there's optimism from a Romney advisor. What do you say, Chris Lehane?
You know, I think it's a little bit of a page out of the Bill Clinton playbook. Which is that you need to give this a bigger public branding around it, and you need to put the Republicans in a place where it's in their political self-interest to get to a place to compromise. And one thing I would just note on that may come into play here, which is because of the size of the victory that the Democrats have achieved on the Senate side, there is the chance that the president may actually be able to push this over until the new body comes in. And in particular, because of some of the new economic data out there, there may be a little bit more elasticity in when you actually hit the trigger. And OMB can stretch that time out a bit that will potentially give the president a little bit more time.
Thank you, Chris Lehane. Thank you, Tammy Frisbee. Thank you, Bruce Cain. Another hour of Forum. We're going to talk about state and local, the results from the election in the hour ahead. Stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.